Well, we're in the Gospel of Matthew again tonight, Matthew 23. Each Sunday night, again if you're new here, we take a section of the Bible and look at it in some detail and try and profit from it. We've been going through some of the latter chapters of Matthew under the title For or Against, observing how the hostility to Jesus mounted during the latter days of his life, and particularly amongst the Jewish establishment. And this chapter, Matthew 23, sees Jesus taking apart some primary members of that Jewish establishment. So let's hear God's word in the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 23. Then Jesus said to the crowds and to his disciples, "The teachers of the law and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. So you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Everything they do is done for men to see. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their prayer shawls long. They love the place of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have only one master and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father and he's in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. Woe to you, blind guides! You say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing, but if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath, you blind fools. Which is greater, the gold or the temple that makes the gold sacred? You also say, if anyone swears by the altar, it means nothing, but if anyone swears by the gift on it, he's bound by his oath. You blind men, which is greater, the gift or the altar that makes the gift sacred? Therefore, he who swears by the altar swears by it and by everything on it, and he who swears by the temple swears by it and by the one who dwells in it. And he who swears by heaven swears by God's throne and by the one who sits on it. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you have neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. You should have practiced the latter without neglecting the former, you blind guides! You strain out a gnat, but swallow a camel. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee! First clean the inside of the cup and the dish, and then outside also will be clean. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You are like whitewashed tombs. You look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside, you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside, you are full of hypocrisy and wickedness. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous, and you say, if we had lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the sin of your forefathers, you snakes, you brood of vipers. How will you escape being condemned to hell? Therefore I am sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify. Others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town. And so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Have you ever had that unnerving experience of catching a glance of yourself in a mirror without realizing it is a mirror? For a moment, you find yourself confronted by a stranger, someone unfamiliar, someone unrecognizable. It's a bit of a shock when you realize this alien being is, in fact, you. If you hold on to that strange feeling for too long, you can find yourself asking some very disturbing questions about personal identity. Is that individual who stares back at me from the mirror's surface really me? Do I really know him or her? You feel perhaps a little bit like Alice when she first found herself disoriented and bewildered in Wonderland. Dear, dear, she exclaims, how queer everything is today. I wonder if I've been changed in the night. And if I'm not the same, the next question is, who in the world am I? Ah, that's the great puzzle. Puzzle indeed. It's a puzzle that's been explored by many contemporary dramatists. Harold Pinter, for instance, he's preoccupied with the elusiveness of the true self. In some lines from a radio play entitled The Dwarves that was first performed in 1960, he puts his finger on the nub of the matter. Let me read it to you. The point is, who are you? Not why or how, not even what. Who are you? Occasionally, I believe I perceive a little of what you are. But that's pure accident. No, it's nothing like an accident. It's deliberate. It's a joint pretense. We depend upon these contrived accidents to continue. But who are you really? How can I be certain of what I see? You are the sum of so many reflections. How many reflections? Whose reflections? Are reflections all you consist of? Pinter, I think, there is identifying the problem we have, distinguishing image from identity. So much of the time, we are simply wearing masks, aren't we? Externally molded patterns of behavior adopted so that we may fulfill some socially accepted role. The mask of the good father, the loving wife, the obedient child, the diligent student, the keen sportsman, the trusty friend, the committed Christian. There are dozens of such masks in our repertoire. We exchange them all the time. Could it be that this sense of self-consciousness that I experience is in fact then just an artifact of social conditioning, just the sum total of a load of masks? Am I just a kaleidoscope reflecting the image other people want to have of me? I suspect we're getting close there to the deepest anxiety of postmodern men and women, the doubt behind all doubt. Descartes began his great philosophical treatise with those famous words, I think, therefore I am. But is the thinking ego really secure enough to bear the weight of such philosophical confidence? Could it not be that this very self-consciousness that I call I is just a sick joke played on me by my cerebral neurons, having no greater claim to objective reality than a schizophrenic's hallucination? Shakespeare, remember, in Hamlet, affirms the importance of inner integrity. This above all, he says, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as surely the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. But where is this true self to be found, William? That's the problem. All too often, the images we project of ourselves are artificial, roles we play for the benefit of others, which are not really us. Some years ago now, a young undergraduate girl here at Cambridge confessed this to me very candidly. She'd got mixed up in drugs quite badly. And this is what she said. She said, when I go home in the vacation, I am the decent, respectable, virginal, Christian daughter that my parents want me to be. But when I come up to college, I become a wild, dissipated, permissive junkie. And she says, the trouble is, I don't really know which is the real me. I had a lot of sympathy for that girl. She, as I suspect all we do, all of us do in various ways, knew she was victim to inconsistency and unreality, and it was really getting to her. She did have one thing on her side, as I tried to explain to her. At least she was aware of this pattern of pretense that she wove about herself, and as a result she was suspicious of her motives. She was critical of her insincerity. She longed to find some kind of more secure stance, some nobler stance of inward honesty. She wanted this above all, to her own self to be true. Sadly, it isn't always so. There are some who fix the mask so securely to their faces they forget what they really look like. Pretense becomes so habitual they are no longer conscious that it is pretense. And even more sadly, I fear there is no sphere where that kind of self-deception is more obvious or discreditable than the sphere of religion. We have it affirmed by no one less than Jesus himself in our study passage, don't we? That religion can be full of hypocrisy. Again and again, as he catalogues this denunciation of the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, the religious establishment of his day, he prefaces his remark with this somber warning, woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. In the ancient world, of course, a hypocrite was quite literally an actor, a person who wore a mask in order to play a dramatic role on the stage. Jesus then, rather like Harold Pinter, observes that such theatricals are not confined to the stage. They're in the religious world too. He perhaps perceives the tragedy in such a failure to discover the real self even more powerfully than Pinter does. What shall it profit a man, he says somewhere else, if he gains the whole world and loses his soul? Make no mistake about it. When we talk about this subject of hypocrisy, losing the soul is what it's all about. Losing who you really are. If we're going to be appropriately searched by this passage, it's important we understand who these Pharisees and teachers of the law were. The Pharisees were a party of fundamentalist laymen. They were passionately committed to the inerrancy of the Bible. They were diligent Sabbatarians. They were ardent churchgoers. They were zealously disciplined in personal prayer. In short, if they were with us today, there is a very high degree of probability they would be members of Eden Baptist Church. or one of the other evangelical churches in Cambridge. As for the teachers of the law, they were professional Bible students. Many of them were Pharisees, but they were distinguished from the Pharisees in that they were professionals. They made their living by their scrupulous attention to the text of the Bible and their painstaking scholarship in their interpretation of it. Some of them gave public lectures in the temple. They taught classes of students. Their advice was sought on matters of biblical interpretation and legal jurisprudence. Some of them became national figures of renown because of their academic achievements. So if they were with us in Cambridge today, there's a high degree of probability they would be attached to the Divinity School. And in view of their theological conservatism and their interest in biblical studies, they would no doubt be frequent visitors to the Tyndale Library. See, as classes of people, teachers of the law and Pharisees are not unique to first century Judea. They bear an uncomfortable similarity to precisely the sorts of people we are here. And though it saddens me to say it, the subversion of true spirituality which they represented in the first century, and which Jesus so ruthlessly exposes in this chapter, is all too common in the evangelical constituency we belong to. What is it the man in the street says about the church? Oh, he says, it's full of hypocrites. And tragically, that dismissive jibe too often has truth in it. Jesus seems to anticipate it might have truth in it. Do you notice whom this diatribe is actually directed to? In verse 1, we're told he's saying it to the crowds and to his disciples. In verse 8, in fact, he quite deliberately turns specifically to his disciples in the second person, you, warning them that they could all too easily be lured into the same kind of spurious religiosity that he's criticizing in the Jewish establishment. So this evening we're being summoned to self-examination on this issue. As we look at these characteristics of hypocrisy, which Jesus denounces with such venom, let's make sure we do so, not pointing the finger at others, but with our eyes looking in the mirror at that rather disquieting and perhaps unfamiliar image which it reflects back to us. Look first with me at the lousy model of spirituality which Jesus says these teachers of the law and the Pharisees were in verses 2 to 4. They sit in Moses' seat, he says, so you must obey them and do everything they tell you, but do not do what they do, for they do not practice what they preach. They tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, but they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. At first sight, maybe, it's rather unexpected that Jesus is quite so positive about the teaching of the scribes and the Pharisees. You must obey them and do everything they tell you, he says. In other parts of Matthew's Gospel, and even in this very chapter, we find Jesus quite explicitly contradicting aspects of the teaching of the scribes and the Pharisees. Some argue that that means Jesus is to be understood here as only endorsing the teaching of the scribes insofar as it faithfully reflects the law of God. He's not issuing a carte blanche endorsement of their teaching, but one which is conditional upon their being true to that seat, Moses' seat, on which they claim to sit. Others suggest that Jesus is speaking here in verse 2 ironically, with his tongue in his cheek. Well, do what they say if you must, but for goodness sake, don't do what they do. For myself, I suspect actually this is an example of Jesus cautioning against a potential misunderstanding of his own radical teaching, a caution which we find in other parts, particularly of Matthew's Gospel. He doesn't want to be interpreted as encouraging some kind of antinomian rejection of Old Testament authority. As the guardian of the biblical constitution of Israel, the scribes and the Pharisees were to be respected. Paul would later tell Christians to respect the Roman authority And I think for probably rather similar reasons, because Christians are not to gain the reputation of being moral anarchists in the society they belong to. But, urges Jesus, though you may respect them for the sake of the office they bear, beware of emulating their behavior, because there is a yawning performance gap in their lives. They do not practice what they preach. No, they tie up heavy loads and put them on men's shoulders, and they themselves are not willing to lift a finger to move them. Some suggest Jesus means in verse 3 that the scribes and the Pharisees didn't keep the rules they imposed on others. They didn't practice what they preached. And that perhaps may be partially his intention. No doubt there were plenty in first century Jerusalem who hid a sordid private life behind a veneer of sanctimonious cant. But actually, for what it's worth, the scribes and the Pharisees were quite fanatically consistent in their religious observances. It's not actually true on the whole to say that they didn't keep the rules they laid down. They tried very hard to keep them. So maybe Jesus' point here is not so much that they pretended to be holier than they really were, as that they claimed to preach biblical religion. They sat in Moses' seat. But what they actually modeled with their lives was a hopeless distortion of that biblical truth. For instead of that careful balance which the Bible establishes between the law of God and the grace of God, these scribes and Pharisees erected instead a tedious mass of empty rituals and petty regulations. They burdened people, as Jesus says here in verse 4, tying heavy loads and placing them on their shoulders. They bowed down the soul with guilt and despair because they offered no prospect of divine help or mercy to alleviate this remorseless weight of failure which their rules inevitably imposed. They desiccated the word of the living God into a laborious routine of do's and don'ts. Where the Bible offered mercy, they offered rules. Where the Bible offered forgiveness, they offered more rules. Where the Bible offered God's grace, they offered still more rules. They insisted that people couldn't be accepted by God unless they dotted every I and crossed every T of their impossibly complicated system. And if you ask, why did they do that? Well, I suspect it's close to the mark to say it's because it was in their professional interest to do so. They were lawyers, you see. The more rules, the better, as far as they were concerned. All lawyers believe that. They weren't really interested in people's spiritual welfare. They were interested in their power base within the Jewish community. Their religion was designed to consolidate themselves as the self-styled spiritual elite of Judaism. It was not designed to save sinners. All too clearly, in the subsequent verses, Jesus details this hypocrisy that focused around themselves and their own interests almost totally. There was the hypocrisy of their lifestyle, for start, in verses 5 to 7. Everything they do is done for men to see, complains Jesus. They make their phylacteries wide and the tassels of their prayer shawls long. They love the places of honor at banquets and the most important seats in the synagogues. They love to be greeted in the marketplaces and to have men call them rabbi. See, a Pharisee was never happier than when they caught an admiring glance from the corner of their eye. Ooh, look, darling, says a Jewish mother to her young son. There goes a Pharisee. You can tell how holy he is by those leather boxes he wears on his arms. They have the holy scriptures in, you know. And you see those long tassels on his prayer shawl? Moses told us to wear those so we would remember his commandments. Oh, look, there he is greeting one of the scribes from the temple. What an honor it must be to walk in such spiritually elevated company. Now, make sure, my son, you bow and call him rabbi reverentially when he passes. We know from other comments in the Gospel the delight the Pharisees and the scribes took in this kind of public histrionic. Sometimes it went to ludicrous lengths. They would always make sure they sat in the front pew in the church. They would pray grandiloquent prayers in a very loud voice with their arms raised on the street corner so everyone could see. When they were going to give to charity, would sometimes hire a trumpeter to announce their intentions, so everybody had the opportunity to watch. And when they were fasting, well, perhaps that was the most farcical of all, they deliberately exaggerated the signs of their austerity with cosmetics applied to their face and their hair, so their humiliation was duly noted by the general public. I could go on and on. Their entire religion was, as Jesus says here, performed to be seen by men. It was a piece of theatre, a piece of exhibitionism. Thus, you know, when you feel insecure about your personal identity, when you look in the mirror and you're not sure who you are, one classic defense is to project a grandiose image of self-importance, to try and convince yourself you are somebody, really. The image in the mirror perhaps seems sadly unimpressive, so decorated with the cosmetics of artificially extrovert behavior. Make people notice you. Maybe you'll feel okay about yourself if people notice you. Maybe you'll feel like you're a somebody instead of a nobody. But for Jesus, you see, such narcissistic self-promotion was quite clearly sickening. See what he says in verse 8? You are not to be called rabbi. You have only one master, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he's in heaven. Nor are you to be called teacher, for you have one teacher, the Christ. The greatest among you will be your servant. For whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. Of course, evangelical Christians don't make their phylacteries wide, do they? They just carry very, very large Bibles. They don't put tassels on their prayer shawls, do they? They just put bumper stickers in their cars. And as for titles, well, rabbi is never heard amongst us. The pastor is sometimes given the same reverential weight. And one dreads to think what Jesus would have said about people who dare to call a brother Christian my Lord Bishop. The exhibitionism then, the hypocrisy of their lifestyle. Would that that was all, but there's more. There's the hypocrisy of their missionary work too. Look at verse 13. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You shut the kingdom of heaven in men's faces. You yourselves do not enter, nor will you let those enter who are trying to. Woe to you, teachers of the law, you Pharisees, you hypocrites! You travel over land and sea to win a single convert, and when he becomes one, you make him twice as much a son of hell as you are. There were, you see, in the Greco-Roman world of the first century, quite a lot of people who were interested in Judaism. And the Pharisees, it seems, made a beeline for people like that. No prize fostered their self-esteem more glamorously than that of a Gentile proselyte to their name. It's like a Red Indian gaining a scalp. But complains Jesus, instead of introducing such seeking souls to the kingdom of God, all the Pharisees and the scribes do is turn them into stereotyped clones of their own legalistic sect. They're not really interested in bringing people into a relationship with God. They simply want more members of their smug little mutual admiration society. Once again, you see, when you feel insecure about who you are, another way of defending against your insecurity is to become fanatically zealous in a cause, to create some clique, some cult, some sect, and foster its reputation with all your might and main. Find your identity in that privileged sense of belonging to that little group. We are God's chosen few, all others will be damned. There's no room in here for the likes of you, we can't have heaven crammed. Of course, evangelical Christians would never display such sectarian arrogance, would they? Their missionary endeavors would always be done with the best of motives, never out of a spirit of one-upmanship, seeking to leapfrog other Christian groups or parties. The goal of our evangelism is never to foster the prestige of our own church, or our own denomination, or our own parachurch organization, is it? Not half it, isn't it? Then there was the hypocrisy of their holiness. Perhaps this is the worst of all. It begins at verse 16 and goes on a long while. Woe to you, blind guides, says Jesus. You say if anyone swears by the temple, it means nothing. But if anyone swears by the gold of the temple, he's bound by his oath. You blind fools. The background to this, of course, is that oath-taking was quite a regular feature of ordinary life in first century Judea. Legal contracts were a rarity, written legal contracts, that is. Commercial deals were usually sealed in the first century on the basis of a spoken promise. And in order to render those spoken promises legally binding, an oath was often added. So oath-taking was a common and an important facet of commercial and business life. Of course, the scribes and the Pharisees were often challenged with the problem of getting out of such a contract. How do you make a promise without actually making a promise? How do you tell someone in business you're going to do something and keep the ace up your sleeve of not doing it? That was a sort of problem they delighted in, how to evade the force, the moral force of God's law. And they engaged in all kinds of casuistic device in order to succeed in that evasion. Jesus is putting his finger on one particular example of that here. You see, they said, if you swear by the gold of the temple, you have to keep your word. That's a legally binding oath. If, on the other hand, you only swear by the temple, then you can break your word with impunity. It's not a legally binding oath. Or if you swear by the gift on the altar, it's a binding oath, but if you only swear by the altar, you're not bound. So you see, they undermined truth speaking in the world of commerce with legal loopholes. It's not hard to imagine the sort of conversation that went on. Good morning, Rabbi Benjamin. You promised to pay me that 50 shekels you owe me today. Oh, I'm sorry, Rabbi Joseph. Don't you remember? I only swore by the temple I would give it to you. I'm afraid I really can't manage it today. So no doubt it went on. Jesus had no time for such Jesuitical legalism, any more than he had patience with their nitpicking attitudes towards the tithe. Look at verse 23. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You give a tenth of your spices, mint, dill, and cumin, but you've neglected the more important matters of the law, justice, mercy, and faithfulness. So I guess many of you know the tithe was a law laid down by Moses, requiring Jews to contribute a tenth of their income to support the Levitical priesthood and to relieve the poor. But once again, these scribes and Pharisees have developed it into a tiresome routine, whereby the really pious individual contributed not just 10% of his money, but 10% of even the garden herbs which he kept in his kitchen to flavour his food. That's what they're referring to here, in dill and mint and cumin. Such a pedantic attention to detail, of course, is these days, if presented to a counsellor, quite clearly an example of obsessional neurosis, the sort of compulsive behaviour which we would call neurotic. Equally today, most counsellors would recognise that behind that kind of compulsive neurotic behaviour lies a feeling of guilt, a desire to avoid guilt. All of us deep inside know we're failures. All of us deep inside suffer from a personal sense of devastation as a result of our guilt. So in order to escape that personal devastation, one way is to concentrate on the observance of little rules. Rules which, though they may be irksome, we can keep if we really try hard enough. In this way, you see, we divert our attention, we distract our attention from the really big rules with regard to which our obedience can never be satisfactory, and which therefore constitute an inexhaustible source of moral anxiety for us. Legalism of this sort, pedantic legalism of this sort, is just a substitute for repentance. People get involved in this kind of rule-keeping in order not to feel guilty. It's not, says Jesus, what you Pharisees are doing. It's the reason for which you do it. It's all a way of evading the full force of God's moral requirement on your life. You have neglected the more important matters of the law with all these silly little rules of yours. Justice and mercy and faithfulness. You strain out a gnat from your tea, but you swallow a camel. Of course, I'm sure when the deacons have a look in the offertory bag over there a little later on tonight, they won't find any diced mint in it at all. We're not into tithing our herbs. But there are plenty of rigid and obsessional personalities in the church who use rather similar tactics to avoid the big moral issues. We make little rules for ourselves, don't we? Some churches make a whole host of them. Some churches assess your spirituality by what version of the Bible you carry, by whether a lady wears a hat or not, or whether a boy wears a tie or not. They make rules about what you can do and can't do on Sunday. They have rules about how long your quiet time should be, whether you should use thee and thou in your prayers. They have rules about practically everything. And they're all invented for the same reason. Because insecure people want to feel good about themselves. When you examine your life in the light of the really big rules, you know what a failure you are. And rather than face the humiliation of that penitence, we would rather create a whole mass of little rules in our churches so that we can feel we are holy. Jesus has no time for it. Any more than he has time for their washing routines. Look at verse 25. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. Blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the dish, and then the outside also will be clean. Again, this is all related to a law of Moses, a law of ceremonial washing. He laid down that certain kinds of ritual defilement were to be cleansed with water. Often there were such washing receptacles in people's homes in the first century in order that people could comply with those Mosaic regulations. But once again, just as with the tithe, the scribes had developed ceremonial washings into a way of exhibiting their religious fastidiousness. They had developed these ritual ablutions far beyond anything which Moses laid down. And they were scrupulous in their observance of such detailed rules. Everything had to be washed right, otherwise they wouldn't dare touch it with their lips. Jesus has only contempt for it. Cleanliness for these scribes and Pharisees were not only next to godliness, it was godliness. It defined godliness. It's just a giveaway, says Jesus. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites. You are like whitewashed tombs, which look beautiful on the outside, but on the inside are full of dead men's bones and everything unclean. In the same way, on the outside you appear to people as righteous, but on the inside you're full of hypocrisy and wickedness. You're only interested in externals, he says. Whether the bowl has been washed or not. Clean what's inside. Clean what's inside, he says. That's what real holiness is about. Because you decorate your lives with sanctimoniousness, nobody realizes that inside you're just as corrupt, just as black with sin, as any of the rest of us. Of course, we don't go in for ceremonial washings, do we? No, not at all. But we have our little foibles, don't we? We have our little external labels by which we declare ourselves to be holy Christians. The bowed head before we eat our meals. The religious cliche that replaces yours sincerely at the end of our letters. The text on the wall, the badge on the lapel. Nothing wrong with all those sorts of things, of course. As Jesus would say, there was nothing wrong with many of these rules which the Pharisees set themselves. We can even justify them as witnesses to the world. These are ways we mark ourselves out as different. But that's the point, of course. That's exactly how the Pharisees would have defended their ritual ablutions and their little regulations. They were witnessing to the world that they were a holy people, a distinct people. They were using external marks of behavior and dress to declare that to the world. They were being good witnesses. All well and good, says Jesus. But the real test is what's going on inside. Is the house really clean? Or is the dust just being swept under the carpet? Perhaps, though, it's as Jesus gets to the end of this terrible tirade that his accusations become the most searching of all. In verses 29 and 36, you see, he exposes the hypocrisy of their reverence for biblical traditions. Woe to you, teachers of the law and Pharisees, you hypocrites! You build tombs for the prophets and decorate the graves of the righteous. And you say, if we had lived in the days of our forefathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. So you testify against yourselves that you are the sons, you are the descendants of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the sin of your forefathers. There's a very stunning, a stinging accusation in these verses here. And yet there's no question, I think, of the legitimacy of what Jesus is saying. Down through the history of the Jews, time and time again, it was the religious establishment who persecuted God's spokesman. Go back to the time of Amos, who was threatened by Amaziah, the priest of Bethel, or Jeremiah, who was beaten up and placed in the stocks at the command of Pasha, one of the chief officers of the temple. In fact, according to Jewish tradition, many of the prophets, perhaps even the majority of the prophets, ended their lives as martyrs. And again and again and again, it was the professional theologians, the establishment people, who were the ones who sentenced them to death. Oh, they were prepared to canonize dead prophets, all right. But living prophets, they executed. And says Jesus, you are just the same. Why did they do it? Well, because, of course, they were not really interested in a contemporary voice from God. It was far too challenging, far too unsettling, far too exposing of their insecurities. It demanded change, and the Pharisees and the scribes had a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. It was precisely the same then in Jesus' day, you see. Galilean peasants could recognize that Jesus was the Messiah. Roman centurions could recognize it. Blind beggars and demon-possessed lunatics could recognize it. But the teachers of the law and the Pharisees conspired to hound him to the cross. And Jesus knows they will do it. You snakes. You brood of vipers. How will you escape being condemned to hell, he asks. Therefore I am sending you prophets and wise men and teachers. Some of them you will kill and crucify, others you will flog in your synagogues and pursue from town to town, and so upon you will come all the righteous blood that has been shed on earth, from the blood of righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. I tell you the truth, all this will come upon this generation. Abel and Zechariah represent, if you like, the A to Z of biblical martyrology. From the beginning of the Old Testament to the end, people who spoke for God by the righteousness of their lives, by the divine authority of their words, have paid the price with their lives. And says Jesus, this generation will prove no different. Indeed, he says, this generation will commit the final and most appalling act of homicidal sacrilege of all. We don't have to guess what he's referring to. But of course, we wouldn't have done it, would we? We evangelicals? No.
We wouldn't have shared in the shedding of the blood of the prophets. Still less in the shedding of the blood of Christ. Or would we? See, they were so secure in their biblical orthodoxy, so smug about their moral righteousness, so convinced they had God on their side, they couldn't recognize the Christ. And he walked through the door. Are you sure we could? Something very tragic, isn't there? Something extraordinarily poignant about these closing verses. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you. How often I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. Look, your house is left to you desolate. I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Oh yes, they would recognize his messiahship eventually. But it would be all too late then. For that would not be the day of salvation. That would be the day of judgment. There remains, you see, one person who, while he watches our performances on the stage of life, is never fooled by those false images we present upon it. He sees through the facade of affectation that we erect. He sees through the mask of pretense that we wear. He observes the hidden inconsistencies. He discerns the ulterior motives. He perceives the secret fraud. He is never deceived. He walks in the light, and one day he will judge us with the searchlight of that truth. He's not offering Oscars for actors who've given a good performance. He's offering crowns for disciples who have followed his son. There is something very tragic about this. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. In fact, there's something very tragic about that cry of woe that echoes through the whole of this chapter. For you know, it is not a cry of anger, that cry woe, not even a cry of menace. Woe is the word they wailed over a coffin at a funeral. This is a cry of anguish. It's a cry of grief. Jesus pities these hypocrites. For all his hard words against them, he sees them as pathetic. He sees them as doomed to have their delusion shattered by the awful blast of divine judgment. Listen to his appeal. I've longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings. But you were not willing. Locked into their false images, you see. They could not really see themselves as God saw them. Blind guides, so blinded were they by their hypocrisy, they could not recognize the Savior when he came. They could not recognize their own spiritual peril. Is it possible God could say the same about us? We have to beware, don't we, of taking refuge in labels. Labels like evangelical Christian. There's no more security in that label than there is in the label Pharisee or teacher of the law. Who are we? When we look in the mirror. That's the key question, isn't it? Who are we? Be real with God, my friend. Be real in the secret place. Oh, I agree, when we're mixing with other people, we have to wear masks. Can't survive socially without putting on some socially acceptable pattern of behavior. But there is a place. There is a place where you can be alone with God. There is a place where no social conditioning forces you to be anything at all except what you are. And there, in your relationship with Him, you can know your real identity. You were made for such a relationship. That's the point. All human relationships, all our relationships with anybody, even the closest friends and loved ones that we have, are distorting to us. They impose upon us in ways that we can't escape. There is one relationship, one ultimate relationship, for which we were made and by which our true identity is defined. It's our relationship with our Creator, the God who made us. In the absence of that relationship, of course we are confused about questions of identity. Of course we don't know who we are. Of course we lose our souls. There's only one place we can discover who we really are. And that is the secret place, where God alone is there to meet us. Be real with God. Let's pray together.